Well, I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and it's really kind of a coveted position. I have the least controversial topic in the history of this study. All of you will be asleep in case you were inclined to make any controversy, and so pretty nice, really, for me. I did, you know, Glenn laid out several books that he used in his study and found helpful on the communion table. I have two. All of these books I found very helpful in making this particular sermon. I would recommend you buy them, in fact. That's another nice advantage of having this topic. The worst that could happen, maybe I'll make a few sales. No, in all seriousness, I'm very glad to be here and very glad to be able to speak on this particular matter. As some of you may be aware, in June of this year, I published this book with the same title as the presentation, and the book was the outgrowth of a series of unusual interactions that I've had for the last 2 years with some brethren from the Multiple Cups churches. And I was asked to spend some time explaining those experiences, and in particular, sharing some of the things that I've learned about the current relations between our respective fellowships and some information that was new to me and will perhaps be new to many of us, which I located in my research for the studies. I want to state at the outset that I'm going to refrain from using any names in this presentation of any individuals who I met or contacted over the course of the last couple of years, simply because I'm not sure that what those brothers told me in conversation was intended to be rehearsed at a gathering like this, which will be videoed and posted on the internet. And so those parts of my presentation that relate to my experiences are going to be anecdotal and uncorroborated. And that's as much as they will be, but I think that will be sufficient for our purposes. In May 2018, I began a conversation in a Facebook group with a large number of preachers from the Multiple Cup churches, both mainline and non-institutional. Some of you who are here are in that Facebook group. And that conversation centered around a poll questioning how many of them would support having a man who believed in one loaf and one cup to preach to their congregation. Well, the overwhelming response was negative and vitriolic, rather typical in the historic discussion here in many respects. But one man messaged me to ask if there were any congregations that use one loaf and one cup near his community, because he was open to hear and learn more. As it happened, there is a congregation less than 10 minutes from his home, and I was scheduled to do some work with that congregation just about 2 weeks later. So during that visit, we met and we had a cordial and a very productive conversation. We got into a car accident together and all sorts of things that tend to bring people close and tend to happen when I'm around. And in the end, he graciously offered me the opportunity to speak at a regional study that he helps to organize in the Chicagoland area, mostly involving the non-institutional congregations in that region. Those brethren were interested in having me visit and present on the history, the texts, and the rationale of the one loaf, one cup position and the brotherhood that has formed around that position. It's important, I think, to know that that was the offer I accepted. And in preparation for the study, I determined that it would be helpful to compose a companion book. Maybe if you've read the book, you've wondered why I included some material that maybe seemed superfluous to what you would have expected, but it had much to do with the questions that were initially asked me. I did not think that I would have adequate time in the presentation for reasons that have already been mentioned by some of my friends in this assembly. In fact, as I was putting this sermon together, I was thinking about an old sermon that Brother B.F. Leonard preached called Short Jabs. And my outline is a little cattywampus and schlatschgoggling, and I think maybe you could call it short jabs on the Lord's Supper, except when I preach it, it will be overextensions on the Lord's Supper. Oh, somebody loaned that to me as well, so that's of course something that could happen. But in this case, I decided that to give a full treatment to the issue for an unfamiliar audience, it would be valuable to write a companion book. Well, in my opinion, that study in December 2018, was the most gentlemanly, productive study in which the Spirit of Christ was manifest and charity was demonstrated in a serious interest in the teaching of the Bible that I've ever known or of which I have ever been a part. Since that time, over the course of the last year, I was asked to conduct other studies of a similar nature in Alabama, Connecticut, Florida, and Jamaica. And some of these have been positive in their own right, but none has been as encouraging as the Chicago study, which seems to still be producing good results more than a year later. Before I share some of my thoughts on the state of the multiple cup churches and the relationship between us and them, I want to share some of the things of special interest that I learned during the preparation for the study. I did not expect to find much new, considering that this is an issue our brethren have seriously analyzed and argued and expounded for more than 100 years. However, there were certain factors that actually allowed for the discovery of some material, which I believe is very meaningful, that has simply been inaccessible during most of that century. Most of the relevant historical data regarding the introduction of individual cups into the churches of Christ and the subsequent division caused by that innovation was recorded exclusively in the prominent and some not so prominent religious journals from the time, especially the Gospel Advocate and the Firm Foundation. Since the time of their publication, these journals have been available only in hard copy and microfilm edition with no catalog and no index of their material. That meant that research was inescapably laborious, lengthy, and ineffective for people like Ronnie Wade when he wrote The Sun Will Shine Again Someday or other similar literature that was produced over the last several years. However, in the last year, both of these journals and several others from the same period have been digitized and made available in fully searchable, high-quality PDF scans. In an incident which the Apostle Paul would have likely suggested was providential, I was able to secure those scans and thereby to research this history on a level that was simply impossible to previous generations of researchers. Now, most of what I share today are fascinating revelations from that research that occasionally correct common misconceptions among our own brethren regarding history, but are in fact quite supportive to the truth on this matter. Our brethren have worked tirelessly and effectively to establish the biblical testimony that when Jesus and the disciples observed the Lord's Supper for the first time, it involved the whole group sharing one undivided loaf of unleavened bread and one cup containing the unintoxicating fruit of the vine. In the book of Acts and 1 Corinthians, we learn that the same pattern was followed and bound on all the churches throughout the world as an integral aspect of what it meant to observe the Lord's Supper. The whole congregation would come together into one place and share the loaf, each breaking off a piece, and drink together from the cup. In my book, I certainly address the biblical testimony and come to the same conclusions that our brethren have reached for decades and decades by simply reading the text. Readers may be interested in those sections to find some amens from the scholarly world that they did not know about, but in general, that section of the book, I think, will be very familiar to all of our brethren. Beyond the apostolic era, there are numerous writings in those who are called the church fathers that clearly show Christians communing with one loaf and one cup for several centuries. However, from as early as the time of Justin Martyr, who lived and wrote between 100 and 165 AD, within just a few years of the death of Apostle John, the early Christians began to depart from the apostolic model in some significant ways. Yet upon careful analysis, the details of these departures actually support our interpretation of the apostolic practice and our understanding of the ordinance. In his first apology, chapter 65, Justin Martyr offers this description of Christian worship in his day. "There is then brought to the president of the brethren bread and a cup of wine mixed with water. And he taking them gives praise and glory to the Father of the universe through the name of the Son and of the Holy Ghost, and offers thanks at considerable length for our being counted worthy to receive these things at his hands. And when he has concluded the prayers and thanksgivings, all the people present express their assent by saying Amen. And when the president has given thanks and all the people have expressed their assent, those who are called by us deacons give to each of those present to partake of the bread and wine mixed with water over which the thanksgiving was pronounced. And to those who are absent, they carry away a portion." Now, this citation has been known to our brethren since at least the days of Brother J.D. Phillips, who published it in his book, The Cup of the Lord. And it does establish that in the assembly, a single loaf and a single cup were shared by the whole congregation. There may be other matters that are questionable and unusual in certain aspects of the language, but at least that much information is evident from this citation. However, we note that by this time, some congregations had the practice of taking the Lord's Supper out of the assembly and delivering it to those who had been absent. Virtually all scholars believe that this refers to those who were very ill or aged and for some reason incapable of assembling. Now, there have been many speculations regarding how the deacons would deliver a portion to those who were absent. Mosheim, who wrote his ecclesiastical history well more than two centuries ago, suggests that this was the first use of a divided loaf and multiple cups. And his understanding was followed by Dr. H.M. Painter, who wrote this in his book, The Holy Supper. "As the words of the institution were being repeated, the bread was broken, divided into several portions, and wine was poured out successively." Now, both of these men believed that the original Christian practice was not this, but that such a practice developed very early in the post-apostolic period. However, this is purely supposition, and it has no historical support. Instead, the history suggests something very different. In Henry Percival's Excursus on Communion for the Sick, in the English translation of the Apostolic Fathers, Dr. Percival, who was an expert on the writings of the patriarchs or of the fathers of the church, agrees with McClintock and Strong that the practice in the East where Justin lived was originally by intinction. Now, I have a modern picture of intinction here in case you wonder what it means. It means dipping the bread in the grape juice or the Oreo in the milk. We can look at this other picture that's maybe more relevant and we can talk about it in a moment. But this is the quote from Dr. Percival. "Whether this at the time was usual, it is hard to say. But there can be no doubt that even in the earliest times, the sacrament was given, on rare occasions at least, in one kind, sometimes under the form of bread alone, and when the sick persons could not swallow, under the form of wine alone. The practice called intinction, that is, the dipping of the bread into the wine and administering the two species together, was a very early introduction and is still universal in the East." Now, what we have pictured here is a drawing by M.C. Tiers, who was a close personal friend of Thomas Campbell and Alexander Campbell. And that's a picture of Thomas Campbell waiting on the table and practicing intinction. He is dipping the bread into the vessel which contains the fruit of the vine. It was evidently something that was practiced in the American Restoration Movement. We can talk more about that in a moment. But what I want to make the point of is that this practice seems to have been introduced by the churches in the East where Justin Martyr lived as the method by which the Lord's Supper was taken out of the assembly and shared with those who were not able to attend. The same loaf which had been shared by the congregation was broken into pieces and dipped into the same juice which had been shared by the congregation from the same cup in which it had been consecrated and shared by the congregation. Although this was a departure from the original practice, I suggest that it was an extreme effort to maintain identity between what the sick consumed and what the congregation had consumed at the earlier assembly. And I think that they would have justified it on that basis, because at this time, joint participation in the same emblems was still understood as an essential component of the Lord's Supper. And I believe the use of intinction helps to establish how strong that conviction was. These people believed that whoever took the Lord's Supper needed to share the same loaf, the same fruit of the vine, from the same cup. And they formed what I would consider an imperfect and an inadequate way of trying to do that, but one that was satisfactory at least to their own conscience. When multiple cups were first introduced, the earliest testimony of this practice is after the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD. The reason for the innovation was evidently the increase in the size of congregations after the legalization of Christianity. That's the consensus of scholars who offer any comment. This is, I don't have it up there, so if you wonder, I have it printed in here. It's from the Divine Liturgy of St. Mark the Apostle, which mentions the use of multiple cups in the Lord's Supper after the Council of Nicaea and the Nicene Creed was already in use. However, the use of multiple cups and loaves was not at that time universal. It was an exception implemented only when deemed absolutely necessary. And this is evident by the language of the patristic writers, even a century after the Council of Nicaea, regarding their understanding of the nature of the supper as a communion of the whole congregation in a single loaf and single cup. Consider these two quotes from Augustine's homilies. "In this loaf of bread, you are given clearly to understand how much you should love unity. I mean, was the loaf made from one grain? Weren't there many grains of wheat? But before they came into the loaf, they were all separate. They were joined together by means of water and a certain amount of pounding and crushing. Brothers and sisters, just remind yourselves what wine is made from. Many grapes hang in the cluster, but the juice of the grapes is poured together into one vessel. That too is how the Lord Christ signified us, how he wished us to belong to him, how he consecrated the sacrament of our peace and unity on his table." Now, I share these quotations in particular because they're very clear. The word cup is not being used metonymically. Juice is poured into one vessel, he says. And based on my research, these quotations have never appeared in any of our brethren's publications, including the writings of Brother Phillips and others. They establish that the theologians in the early centuries of Christianity understood that unity and joint participation in common emblems was a major aspect of the meaning of the Lord's Supper. In the testimonies regarding how a plurality of loaves and cups were used from the 4th century on to the 19th centuries, the same interest in maintaining joint participation, even if imperfect, for the same theological reasons is very clear. In the book, I've included a large number of passages that have only been translated into English in the last 15 years from writers in the French, Swiss, and Polish Reformation movements, all of which clearly articulate an interest in seeing that the whole congregation is sharing emblems. If multiple cups were used, the fruit of the vine was first blessed in a single vessel and then poured into other vessels, which would in turn be shared by groups of congregants, just as they would have shared one cup had only one cup been offered. This was the common practice of congregations in all Protestant bodies, as well as in the Restoration movements in the congregations throughout the United States. The Nashville congregation, the Church of Christ in Nashville, where David Lipscomb attended when he left the Baptist Church as a teenager, during the time of Jesse B. Ferguson, had over 600 members, and they used as many as 8 cups to serve that crowd in their 2-story meeting house. But before the distribution, the juice was blessed in one of these large pitchers. This is a sampling of the sort of communion sets that were commonplace in the 19th century and earlier in the Churches of Christ and in the Protestant denominations. Over in this area is the communion set for Brush Run Church, where Alexander Campbell worshiped. According to all the testimonies that I found, they never used all 3 cups. They generally used only one, but on occasion, for crowd's sakes, they would use 2. But even when they only used 1 cup, much like this communion set, which was the set at Green Street Church of Christ, where James Harding preached, the fruit of the vine would be blessed in the pitcher, poured into the single cup, passed round the room until it was exhausted, then brought back up, and the cup would be replenished from what was remaining in the pitcher. This was a picture of the communion sets sold in the Gospel Advocate during the 1800s. And I think it's important for us to understand that. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. Alexander Campbell, in his notebook, wrote about a congregation he visited that used only 1 loaf and 1 cup on the Lord's table. And he described that as a novel practice, but very admirable. He says, "I observed that the table was furnished before the disciples met in the morning, and that the disciples occupied a few benches on each side of it, whilst the strangers set off on seats more remote. The president, the one who presided over the service, arose and said that our Lord had made a table for his friends, and that he invited his disciples to sup with him. In memory of his death, this monumental table," said he, "was instituted, and as the Lord ever lives in heaven, so he ever lives in the hearts of his people. As the first disciples, taught by the apostles in person, came together into one place to eat the Lord's Supper, and as they selected the first day of the week in honor of his resurrection for this purpose, so we, having the same Lord, the same faith, and the same hope with them, have vowed to do as they did. We owe as much to the Lord as they, and ought to love, honor, and obey him as much as they." Thus having spoken, he took a small loaf from the table, and in 1 or 2 periods gave thanks for it. After thanksgiving, he raised it in his hand and significantly broke it, and handed it to the disciples on each side of him, who passed the broken loaf from one to another until they all partook of it. There was no stiffness, no formality, no pageantry. All was easy, familiar, solemn, cheerful. He then took the cup in similar manner and returned thanks for it and handed it to the disciples sitting next to him, who passed it round, each one waiting upon his brother until all were served." Again, there are going to be elements of that that we would find perhaps disagreeable or questionable as to what exactly was going on, but other aspects we would find very familiar. So here we come to the first common misconception about the history of the Lord's Supper, even among our own brethren. I frequently hear people say, sometimes even preachers, that prior to the 1890s, all Christians used one loaf and one cup, or that G.C. Brewer introduced multiple cups, and that all the congregations had used one loaf and one cup before him for 1900 years. This is simply false. Since the introduction of multiple loaves and multiple cups for convenience in large crowds around 325 AD, that method of observing the Lord's Supper has been fairly common. And there were many times when it was more common than the use of one loaf and one cup, even in the churches of Christ. On August 24th, 1911, a sister from Iuka, Mississippi, wrote to David Lipscomb in the Gospel Advocate, "Brother Lipscomb, if your contention against the individual communion service is correct, is it not wrong to use more than one cup? If so, we are all guilty of not discerning the one body and blood, for I have never seen a congregation only use one cup, except when there were so few present it required only one deacon to wait on them. How many does the congregation where you worship use?" Now again, if you know your dates and your G.C. Brewer history, you realize that 1911 is before he made his infamous move in Tennessee and began his controversy in the churches to introduce individual cups. Now, this woman does not mention individual cups. She simply mentions multiple cups, a plurality. And her contention is that for many years before she wrote these words, she had never seen, except on very infrequent occasions, the use of only one cup. And although Lipscomb did not respond to her question about the practice in Nashville, we've already noted, and it's well established, that they used between 4 and 8 cups for decades before this time. Now, it does us no good to avoid these historical facts. In fact, it probably does us harm to avoid them. It creates a weakness or a perceived weakness in our presentation. It does us no harm to acknowledge them. If there had not been a corruption, there would be no need for a restoration. And an innovation in 325 AD is no more apostolic than an innovation in 1892 or in 1914. But integrity and interest in the truth demands us to represent things as they really are. I'll have more to say on this in just a moment. Another area in which even our literature is slightly inaccurate regards the first historic use of individual cups in Christendom. It's possible that in some cases, individual cups were given to people who were deemed unfit to commune. There are references that it may have happened during the bubonic plague and at other times throughout history because someone had a serious illness. There are scattered claims of it over 1,500 years, but there are no clear documented cases. However, the common claim that most of us are familiar with, that J.G. Thomas's Market Street Presbyterian Church in Lima, Ohio, first used individual cups of all those who profess Christianity on October 7th, 1894, is not correct. There are at least 8 earlier examples that are well documented, the oldest being the Scoville Avenue Methodist Church in Cleveland, Ohio, on December 6, 1891. I will say the research to establish this has been so meticulous, it is very difficult to imagine that it will ever be disproven. But this is the earliest known case of the use of individual cups in the Lord's Supper. However, there were not enough cups for all the communicants, and so the Lord's Supper took a little bit extra time because they had to go and wash and refill the set in the middle of the ordinance. So Dr. Thomas did not invent individual communion cups, but he did invent the filling machine that popularized their use. Before Dr. Thomas's machine, the filling and distribution of hundreds or thousands of cups was so cumbersome that it was essentially impractical. And the churches that wanted to use them just didn't. And I think this has significant bearing on the question of what the disciples did in Jerusalem. When some people try to paint a picture of tens of thousands of Christians gathering together for the Lord's Supper in that primitive environment, if a congregation of a few hundred struggled to use individual cups in Ohio in 1891, how do we suppose that a congregation of 10,000 managed to do it in first century Jerusalem? I think that's a legitimate question to ask based upon that history. Now, when individual cups were introduced into the churches of Christ, there were originally three groups within the churches: those who used only one loaf and one cup and believed that was essential; those who used multiple loaves and cups but opposed individual loaves and cups; and those who believed that individual loaves and cups were acceptable. At first, and for a period of about 20 years, the second of these groups was by far the largest and the most influential. But the unanswerable charge that their practice was also a departure from the biblical pattern, and their general unwillingness to move to the right on the issue, ensured that they would eventually be shamed into change or silence. Yet it is very meaningful to note that the arguments made by those who used multiple cups yet opposed individual cups, men like David Lipscomb, E.C. Love, and J.M. McCaleb, were based on this contention, that individual cups were a step further than any alteration of the past, and one that would radically and essentially change the way people viewed the Lord's Supper. I will say that E.C. Love repented, and when he died, he and his congregation used only one loaf and one cup on the Lord's table. I found documentation of that, which I intend to print in the second edition of my book. But that they were correct in their distinction between the nature of multiple cups and individual cups is articulated well by C.E. Holt in his infamous letter to David Lipscomb. Listen to his words. "There is no service in which Christians engage where individual fitness and personal responsibility are more strongly emphasized and made conditions of eligibility thereunto than that part of worship called the Lord's Supper. Let a man examine himself is a point to be remembered, and on which much stress is laid. There is one and only one vital point in this part of the worship. It is divinely stated thus, 'Do this in remembrance of me.' It is nowhere stated, yea, not even remotely hinted at, that in eating the Lord's Supper we thereby show our love for and relation to each other. It is not to show that we are members of the church in good standing. While all communicants are or should be members of the one body, yet this is not the divinely appointed way by which this fact is made known." He never even mentions 1 Corinthians 10:17. Which is a strange thing, that no one called him to account for it, and he seems utterly ignorant of its words. But this quote represents the first example of its kind in the churches of Christ. A radical shift from those who used multiple cups for convenience sake, but still made some effort to practice some kind of sharing. I believe that in our presentation of the history, it's very important for us to emphasize this distinction. Although multiple cups and loaves do represent a departure from the biblical pattern and ought to be opposed on that basis, there is a difference between using multiple cups and individual cups, multiple loaves and individual loaves. It is not the same to use two cups and to use individual cups, because the latter fundamentally changes the very nature of the Lord's Supper in the most radical way, utterly dissolving any practical communion of the congregation and turning it into, as Brother Holt said, the ultimate manifestation and monument to individualism. E.C. Love predicted that in time, those who used individual cups would no longer believe it was necessary to assemble to take the Lord's Supper. and his prediction has come true. Our time would not allow me to discuss each of the issues I have up here in any depth, but I want to talk a little bit about some areas where I believe it would do well for all of us to put more emphasis in the future when we discuss these issues. The first is the precise nature of the issues addressed, the controversy in 1 Corinthians 11, part B. The second is the precise nature or point the Apostle Paul is making in his statement about the Lord's Supper in 1 Corinthians 10, 16 through 17, and how it relates to the discussion about eating at the temple feasts. The third is the covenantal system as practiced by the ancient world and how it teaches us about the concept of covenants and the function of covenant signs. Regarding the first of these, I believe there's serious room for improvement. The literature of the Restoration Movement is almost nonsensical on this subject, with virtually no consensus or continuity from one writer to the next, and sometimes no consensus or continuity within the same commentary. In that void, where nobody seems to have any clue what was going on in the church there, the modern mainline and non-institutional congregations, or at least their preachers, have almost universally adopted the view that the original form of observing the Lord's Supper was essentially a full meal that was shared in the assembly, of which the Eucharist was a portion. I don't know how they live with the fact that even what they do is nothing like that. But they use that belief to dismiss any call to restore the primitive practice of the Lord's Supper because they say nobody does it like the church at Corinth obviously did. Among the more traditional preachers, the general interpretation seems to be that the Corinthians would bring their own emblems to the assembly, their own cup, their own juice, their own little piece of bread, and some of the Corinthians who got there early would take the supper before other people arrived. Now, probably all of us would reject those interpretations, and we might scoff at them, but the problem is that if they come across as the more coherent option, then people will accept them over something that is less sensical. And so I think that some of these do come across more coherent than the traditional interpretations of exactly what's happening in 1 Corinthians 11b. The first has a great deal of traditional scholarly support behind it in the broader world, I have some of my own thoughts on a better way of interpreting these passages, but I'm not going to get into them right now. I might bring them up if you want to in the question and answer, but I've expressed them in other places, and so I won't get into it right now. But I believe this is a discussion that we need to have. What was going on in Corinth? And we need to work to a more coherent explanation. The second issue, the argument revolving around the Lord's Supper in 1 Corinthians 10, 16 through 17, I'll simply say that the first time I ever heard these verses actually explained in their context, I was over 20 years old. And it was by Benny Crier at the Green Oaks congregation. Some of you were there for that sermon. I think this is a signal that more focus on expository preaching will help us better defend our practices than simply proof texting in topical discussions. We might be able to find verses that sound very supportive of our position, but they may be much more supportive than we actually thought if we would bother to read them and explain them in their original context. On the covenant issue, I would mention two things. Number one, the King James Version has kept many people from understanding the phrase, "This cup is the new covenant," because it says this cup is the New Testament. And that's led some people to think that the drinking vessel represents the Christian scriptures. And I hear people say that sometimes when they're waiting on the table. In reality, I believe that our understanding of the Lord's Supper would be much more robust and convicting, our conviction rather, regarding the apostolic practice would be even more strong if we would spend some serious time considering Whether the Lord's Supper constitutes a covenant meal, I believe that it does. And the relationship between the blood of the covenant itself, and the sign of the covenant in the ancient system. I think this distinction would be tremendously valuable in assisting honest investigators who have been confused by the metonymy argument. And I found that to be true in my own experiences. If you have questions about any of those things in particular, we can discuss them more, and you can feel free to ask questions about them in the discussion period. But before my time elapses, I do want to spend a little bit of time talking about the more practical observations that I've made. During the last 2 years, I established more relationships and deep and very valued friendships within the Multiple Cups churches than the combined years of my former life. These relationships have given me some special perspective, I think, on the condition of the mainline and non-institutional churches. I had very little interaction with the Mutual Edification Brethren or the non-Sunday School Brethren. But I think that some of the things that I encountered shed light on the future of those groups and what expectations we should have concerning them. Now, I'm going to tell you, this was the most difficult part of the study to write, because I did not want to sound like Jane Goodall talking about her life among the silverback gorillas in Africa. These are people, and these are people, many of them, I love them. I've come to deeply admire and respect them. And I've developed a close relationship with them, and I'll say something more about that in a moment. I do not feel that broad, sweeping statements about them are really appropriate, nor would any be universally accurate, and so they aren't worth much. But I think that all of us can understand, and I think it's true to say, that there is a traditional culture, a moderate culture, and a progressive culture within both the mainline and non-institutional fellowships. I think we would all understand the traditionalists are generally the sort of people who will say that you can call a grape a cup, and will spend their time meeting our arguments by insulting our intelligence. And we all know that. We all experience that from time to time. There are people, certainly, who still take that approach. Conversely, the progressives are those who have adopted such a different view on the authority of Scripture and the nature of the church that they will freely admit that our practice is the biblical, scriptural, original one. But they no longer find that impressive because they do not believe in biblical patterns. And those in this category tend also to embrace even rank theological liberalism, denying the inspiration of the Scripture, the omniscience of Jesus Christ, and things that we would consider to be very fundamental, and that I think would disqualify them from any good work, even if they could be convinced to accept one loaf and one cup for some reason. I think we would all be shocked at the actual number of progressives as opposed to traditionalists. The former far outnumber the latter. I think there's good reason to believe that the mainline and non-institutional churches of Christ, as we have known them for the last 100 years, will virtually disappear in this country, perhaps within the next 20. And the progressive attitude will more and more overtake until they leave the churches of Christ altogether, or the congregations turn into community churches, as is happening in many places. At that time, I believe we will see several older traditionalists and those who we might call moderates coming to worship with us because they have nowhere else to go. In fact, I've had a number of people tell me that that is their full expectation, that they believe they will worship with a one loaf, one cup congregation before they die. They will place membership there, and they'll go along with the things we believe because they will have nowhere else to go. But this will bring some challenges. Some people have the conception that the Multiple Cups Brethren are essentially just like us, except for the fact that they use multiple cups and they have Bible classes. That's not true. Not at all. We can think of it this way, that we're like children birthed of the same mother and father, but separated in our infancy and raised in different households. There are certain things we have in common because of our common genetics, but we have grown up away from each other. We've had different conversations about different subjects, and we've come to different conclusions on a large number of issues. I do suggest that their acceptance of innovations has adversely impacted their ability to practice good and consistent hermeneutics and has created numerous blind spots in their thinking. One brother who recently took his stand with us in Tulsa from a Multiple Cups congregation made this comment: "It looks like you all haven't changed much for the last 100 years, and we haven't quit changing." I found that to be a very profound statement. Something should be said about the moderate culture as well. The congregations that adopted individual cups, even as they have divided from one another over matters like institutionalism, are nonetheless all profoundly institutional in their nature and structure. They have colleges. Even the non-institutional brethren have colleges. They have publishing houses, journals, preaching schools, ministry organizations, and these bind the brethren together in a way that makes taking a stand on any particular issue, even when fully convinced, exceedingly difficult. Although many of the younger up-and-coming leaders have told me that without hesitation, they respect our position, and they would not oppose me and others of us coming and preaching what we believe at their congregations. I've collected a great deal of testimony to that end. Even so, they all acknowledge that in the end, the other members and leaders of the congregation would be staunchly opposed to it. And they are absolutely unwilling to stand up for it if it means the loss of their relationship with their brethren. I saw this myself in Kentucky last September. As I closed a gospel meeting, a young man with whom I'd been studying had a preaching appointment at one of the Multiple Cups churches in town, and I went over to hear him Sunday evening. He was there to solicit financial support from that congregation. And I was very, very disappointed to learn that the church refused to support him because I attended the assembly to listen to him preach. And in the business meeting, the allegation was that he fraternizes with one-cuppers. That's an old attitude, but it is one that has been effectively passed on to the next generation in many places. And consequently, as I conclude my thoughts here, I'll say that I believe any large-scale efforts to convert congregations or subgroups within a brotherhood or whole brotherhoods will be ineffective. But individual efforts can be extremely effective. I've seen it. I believe that it's true. I do not think that debates will be as effective as they once were. I have various reasons for concluding that, but I do think that producing written material and audiovisual material that can be used for one-on-one studies is an urgent need. I published my book because of this, but I do not believe that my book is the final word or the ultimate resource on the matter. My book was written for a very particular audience, and if you read it, you'll probably note that that's the case. But I believe that there is more work to be done, more research, more forms and styles of presenting the data. Sanitation is still, and I suppose always will be, the major issue, even among those who claim that it's not. And that brings up the significant point that the division over the Lord's Supper really had nothing to do from the very start with biblical interpretation. The history bears that out very clearly. But rather it had to do with worldliness and a rejection of the primitive practice that became unacceptable to the sensibilities of Western individualism. I can testify, as so many of us can, of the great frustration and heartache that comes from hitting a brick wall in studies with these brethren. I can testify that especially because I have come to call some of these men dear friends. And I've had moments of extreme emotion and perhaps even of temptation as I've contemplated the great pain of wishing that I could fellowship with them, but seeing no way to do it. But as long as we believe that God wills for unity among his people and is glorified only by obedience to his word, it is a worthy work to do everything we can to confront this issue.